WAUK.
Welcome, Wisconsin. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network here across the state of Wisconsin. Really pleased and humbled to once again welcome Professor Yoshiko Herrera from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She is a professor of political science there, focuses on Russian politics, nationalism, identity, as well as ethnic politics, political economy, and state statistics. Just the right person to have help us understand the present moment that we find ourselves in. She was the recipient in 2011 of the Chancellor's Distinguished Teaching Award at Madison. She's taught at Harvard, way smarter than I could ever hope to be. Welcome, Professor Herrera. Thanks so much for being here yet again. Boy, is it a critical time.
Yeah, thank you. Happy to be on your show.
Wonderful. Let's just jump right into things here. Last week, the U.S. general overseeing military operations in Europe, General Christopher Cavoli, warned lawmakers on Capitol Hill that basically we're at the breaking point. The specific fact that he noted in his testimony before the Armed Services Committee of the House of Representatives was that Russia was expected to hold a 10-to-1 advantage on artillery shells within weeks unless the United States approves additional military support for the government in Kyiv. What is it that bad?
Yes, I've heard reports for a few months now that Russia has a 5-to-1 advantage. And there's more and more, it's really heartbreaking. There's more and more reports that they're rationing ammunition and they simply don't have enough to fight. They have the soldiers in place. And of course they need more soldiers. That's another issue. But people at the front lines are doing all they can and they are starved for ammunition. In addition, cities like Kharkiv are being absolutely bombarded and they lack defensive missile systems like Patriot systems in order to repel Russian missiles and drones. So yeah, it really is.
The very systems that Israel engaged this weekend to defend itself from Iran's drone attack, Ukraine lacks the capacity to use. And that is in large part due to the United States basically holdup of funding since February of this past year when the Senate approved a funding bill, which Speaker of the House of Representatives Mike Johnson has refused to bring to the floor. Here's more from General Christopher Cavoli. This past week, the side that can't shoot back loses, I should say, General. The stakes here are very high. The severity of this moment cannot be overstated. I just don't understand what is not being understood in the House of Representatives. Russian aggression in Ukraine, the fragility of the NATO alliance, the political rhetoric surrounding the NATO alliance, to me just reads as an absolute alarm bell ringing as loudly as it possibly could. Are we really at a tipping point more broadly in terms of whether or not Western allies will really stand up for one another? What's being tested here? What's at stake if Ukraine falls?
Yes, you're absolutely right. There's so much at stake. For one, Russia has made very clear that its intentions are not just a dispute with Ukraine, but it is at war with the West. And that's just abundantly clear from statements from Putin and other government officials. Second, Putin has made agreements with both Iran and North Korea to supply weapons and munitions to Russia. They're getting shells from North Korea. They're getting drones, these Shahed drones, from Iran. And so it's not a figurative axis of evil. It is. Russia is allied with Ukraine, with Iran and North Korea. And you have to wonder, what are Iran and North Korea getting in return? The two things they want, the things that those two states want are nuclear technology, and they want to become nuclear states. This was a huge priority of the United States going back to George W. Bush administration and also to the Obama administration to stop Iran and North Korea from getting nuclear weapons. This was the top foreign policy goal. And with Russia making these deals with Iran and North Korea, we have to think that the transfer of some kind of nuclear technology or enriched uranium or something is on the table for them. And that's very dangerous. And we just saw over the weekend the attacks from Iran on Israel. Iran is using some of the same drones from Iran into Israel that they are giving to Russia being sent into Ukraine. So you can see the global perspective here is that the situation is very dangerous, and were Ukraine to lose, it would embolden Russia further and embolden Iran and other enemies of the United States further.
I don't want to ask you for per se political small politics or partisan political commentary, but what is there any defensible policy position to continue to hold up the Ukraine funding? I would shudder to think that our elected officials cannot understand the connections because they're being briefed on these things. The Armed Services Committee, as well as some with security clearances and SCIFs, are being told, listen, Iran is sharing this technology with Russia. This is in exchange for, again, nuclear tech. Is this not understood? Is there any defensible position to hold up Ukraine's funding?
You know, this is really one of the most frustrating things for me as an American to have to explain, not only to students, I'm teaching a class on the Ukraine war, the Russian war on Ukraine right now, but also, you know, internationally to people that ask, like, what's going on in America? Mm-hmm. And you can imagine a coherent position. Let's say somebody is like Yoko Ono or something, like just an absolute piece of it. Like, I just don't fight. I want everyone to hug each other and I just want peace. Okay, you can imagine a position like that somebody could take. Now, I would say this is a bit of a luxury because lots of Ukrainians would like to live in peace. Lots of Israelis and Palestinians would like to live in peace. Many people around the world would like to just go about their lives. But somebody comes and attacks you, and as they say, the war came to us in Ukraine. So they just don't have the luxury of saying, like, I would prefer not to have a war here. You know, everyone would prefer that. So, yeah, there is you could imagine, though, a coherent position saying, I'm against war. I'm against, you know, all weapons, all military, everything. Okay. But that's not the position of people who are holding up the Ukraine bill. Many of them acknowledge exactly what we've just been saying about the risks, about the problems that would be imminent if Russia were to defeat Ukraine. So they understand that, but they have put up different kinds of things. We remember the border security. I heard Marco Rubio actually just on Sunday saying, well, we need to really support Israel. And when asked about Ukraine, he said, well, you know, of course, yeah, I support Ukraine, but, you know, we needed to fix our southern border. And because the Democrats wouldn't do that, you know, that's why we couldn't do this Ukraine bill. Well, obviously, the southern border is a problem that needs to be addressed, but we can do more than one thing at one time in the United States. And so it's really not a serious argument to say because of this problem, we can't do another problem. So I don't think that's a problem. The issue of saying we're spending too much money on foreign aid is also a non-starter because everybody understands that most of the money to Ukraine would go to U.S. defense manufacturers, and then those weapon systems and weapons would go to Ukraine. So it's actually good for our economy. So I don't think, and the worst to me is the argument that we don't want to have this Ukraine bill or the border security bill go through because it will look like a win for one side, and we don't want that because it's an election year. That's probably, I'd say, the bottom of the barrel in terms of cynicism and cynical politics, because we need to address problems in America and solve them and not get involved in petty, small disputes. And that's one of the frustrating things is I don't see a lot of coherent arguments being made against supporting Ukraine. It's instead a lot of petty politics that are like, well, because of this, that, and the other, we're not doing anything, rather than any kind of consistent, you know, ideological or reasoned approach to not letting the bill go before Congress.
At least put the bill on the House floor and bring it through and out of committee and take an up-down vote on the damn thing and let people make these arguments, Professor Herrera, that you're referring to. And I thank you for bringing up the border question. My response to those arguments are, one, there's been a bill that would give you what you're seeking. It's the most aggressive border bill that a Democratic president has been willing to vote on, and Biden has said he would pass it. So you've gotten what you've asked for. This is all delay tactic, and therefore we revert to reason number three, the most distasteful of all the reasons, and that it's not personally politically beneficial for Donald Trump. But setting all of that aside for a moment, the most reasonable response to the, well, we're not going to fund Ukraine because we haven't solved our immigration problem would be, well, why isn't that true for Israel and aid to Israel as well? Mm-hmm. It's, and right, that's a non-starter for most conservatives. Query why? Again, we get to this place, and again, there are some cynical political calculations being made there. Professor, can you stick with us for another segment?
Sure.
Yes. Wonderful. We're going to take a couple of very brief messages. This is the shortest break in the hour, so don't go anywhere, folks. We're going to continue to dig in. If you've got a question for Professor Herrera, feel free to text it into our text line, 855-752-4842. That's 855-75-CIVIC. I'm Maggie Dawn, guest this half hour, Professor Yoshiko Herrera, helping us understand the precipice that we are on as a nation for the United States and frankly, the Western alliances, if I can put it that way. It's a bit of a World War II reference, but the Western alliances, safety and security in this moment. I want to cue this up because a couple of representatives were quoted as referring to this, and we've heard the former president referring to this issue as well, which is people aren't paying their NATO dues. And so this is why we won't appropriately fund and assist Ukraine with the defense that it needs. I'd like to start there when we come back, Professor Herrera. Again, we are at a moment of just critical juncture for those of you just joining us. General Christopher Cavoli, responsible for the U.S. military operations in Europe, warning lawmakers on the Hill last Wednesday that the war in Ukraine has reached a decisive moment. Russia is expected to hold a 10-to-1 advantage on artillery shells within weeks. They're basically going to be running out of ammunition. The rationing of ammunition has already started in Ukraine. And as General Cavoli said, if you can't fight back, you can't shoot back, you will lose. I'm Maggie Dawn. This is the Civic Media Radio Network. You got a question? 855-75-CIVIC. Back with more in just a moment. World, you're not alone in artists, you're not alone. Welcome, Wisconsin. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening statewide to the Civic Media Radio Network. Joined this half hour by Professor Yoshiko Herrera of the University of Wisconsin, a political scientist, a student, an expert on Russia, teaching a course this semester on the Ukraine-Russia war. We were discussing, Professor, before our brief break, the reasons, what I'm going to call the fig leaves, that folks have trotted out as to why Ukraine funding has not been brought forward on the floor of the House of Representatives for a vote. Folks, just context check. The Senate passed a $95.3 billion Ukraine funding bill back in February. Speaker Mike Johnson hasn't moved the bill. His speakership's been threatened. So, you know, might have something to do with his personal political interest. But the reason that his speakership is being threatened is basically because this has become a useful foil for Donald Trump. Query, why would Donald Trump think Russia being able to defeat and take over Ukraine is good for the United States? I just don't even understand that as a baseline concept. Why do conservatives oppose the funding? I don't get it. There are all sorts of, again, fig leaves. The two most recent being quoted in the Washington Post reporting on this from last week, Representative Corey Mills, Republican of Florida, saying that while NATO was created to stop Russian expansionism, Germany, France, and others in Europe have not, quote, paid their dues by meeting a commitment to NATO to spend 2% of their gross domestic product on defense. Michael Waltz, Republican of Florida, also trotted out that reasoning. He used the word pathetic. And so Waltz went on to extrapolate this. What we need to be focused on, America. When did America's interest, Professor, become supported or bolstered by Vladimir Putin, or our national security improved, or the security of any single one of us as Americans improved if Vladimir Putin takes over Ukraine? I missed that part in my foreign studies course.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that I've thought about this a lot, because why, like, how do you explain to people what is at stake? How do you explain lifelong Republicans who had been, during the Cold War, anti-Soviet, and then skeptical of Russia, just turning around at the worst moment to say, you know, these are people that would have been skeptical of Russia in the 1990s when it was trying to, in fits and starts, embrace democracy. And then as Putin has completely consolidated authoritarian rule, now's the time to say, like, oh, actually, Russia is not so bad. I mean, it just really makes no sense. Like, do you care about freedom? Do you care about religious liberty? Do you care about civil liberties? Like, what kind of things do you care about? And if you care about basically any of those freedoms that we value in America, you cannot be a supporter of Vladimir Putin. So it's just puzzling to me how really, thanks to Donald Trump, there's been a turn to support for certain dictatorships like Putin, even North Korea, Kim Jong-un, Iran. It's just mind-boggling to me how this embrace of dictatorship could have started. Now, we can understand from the Trump perspective, he doesn't like that Ukraine, they didn't help him in his reelection campaign by drumming up dirt on Joe Biden and all that, and so it's kind of a personal thing. But still, the embrace of Putin is very strange. I don't think that makes sense. Logically, it does not make sense. So I don't know. I just puzzle at how could people have started to embrace Putin now, really, which is at like the worst possible time in recent decades.
I find myself oftentimes lacking for any explanation except for the most obvious and rabidly cynical explanations, Professor, and that is deeply disturbing. At some level, whether conservative or liberal, or I hate politics and all of it, what we can agree on is that we want our nation to be secure, that we have enjoyed the privilege of peace for the most part in our country, that our concern and what can happen when we allow ourselves to become complacent, in recent memory, that being of 9/11, the opposing this sort of oppression, political, religious thought, this should be central to our American values and centered in what we should be demanding as the very least from our politicians. It is simply inexplicable from a national security perspective. All of these issues, whether we're talking about the border, of course, or member NATO countries paying their dues, right? Yep. Uh-huh. Can we do that and fund Ukraine? How would exactly Ukraine being defeated help bolster NATO or encourage NATO allies to pay their dues? It's actually the inverse, because you would see the United States retreating, in my opinion, from our leadership role on the international stage for a key ally. To me, that would serve as a marked disincentive to our fellow NATO allies to pay their dues, because it would weaken NATO as a strategic alliance. Is that a fair assessment, Professor?
Yeah, I think the issue of NATO not paying its fair share, I mean, this is something that you can discuss this. The U.S. pays, let's say, 3.5% of GDP. I mean, we have the largest GDP, so in absolute, you know, in actual dollars, we put in the most. But it's 3.5% of our GDP. There are most of the, there are many countries in NATO that are paying more than 2%. That's the supposed to be the norm. And there's a few that are, you know, right under it, like 1.9% something. Okay, but this isn't really, is that really, like, how important is that? You could have this debate about different countries need to pay more. Okay, but to me, this is just really a sideshow, because we have our interests and we have things that we want to do. And so saying it's in our strategic interest that Putin not win in Ukraine and move on to further aggression, why would we say, well, but we're going to put that aside because we think Italy should pay, you know, 0.01% more? I mean, that it just, it doesn't really make sense. So I do think it's worth talking about NATO allies, some NATO allies stepping up, some have, but it's worth talking about it. Germany is the, you know, the other big economy that, excuse me, could be paying a bit more. But
there's separate issues at base. Is that what I'm hearing from you, Professor? She's not like taking a sip. Sometimes we get the little froggy voice when we're live on the radio. Yes. That happens too. Bottom line, what should people be looking for in the next 2 weeks? We've got just under a minute left, Professor.
Well, for one thing, there is a discharge petition to get this bill for funding Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan to the House for a vote. And if it gets there for a vote, it will pass. I mean, this is one of the frustrating things, is not that American Congress people are voting against our interests, but that they're not being given the chance to vote because of procedural rules. So I think the discharge position is really important. And I have to say, my own congressman, Mark Pocan, who normally is a supporter of Ukraine, normally is, I think, on the right side of issues, has still not signed this discharge position. And they need about 20 more signatures. So I think that the discharge position is really important. And there are different organizations trying to get congresspeople on both sides to sign this and get this bill to a vote. That's, I think, the priority right now.
Is call to get your congressperson, tell them to sign the discharge petition. Yeah. We've got to go. We'll be back with more in just a moment. Wisconsin, I'm Maggie Dawn. You are listening to the Civic Media Radio Network statewide. I am joined this hour by Professor Yoshiko Herrera of the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and an expert on the Ukraine war and Russian politics. Just before we got to our farm update, we were talking, Professor, about a discharge petition, which is a way for the House of Representatives to effectively force a vote on the Ukraine aid bill, which has been languishing since February after the Senate adopted a just over $95 billion Ukraine aid package. We're mere weeks away, according to the U.S. General overseeing military operations in Europe, General Christopher Cavoli, will basically weeks away from Ukraine running out of artillery shells, air defense munitions. Without this additional support, Russia is expected to hold, again, within weeks, a 10-to-1 advantage on artillery shells. This is a breaking point in terms of Ukraine being able to hold the front lines. Am I getting the broad strokes of what the discharge petition is, Professor? This would effectively force the vote on the aid package.
Yes, basically the House Speaker is allowed to decide whether or not a bill goes to the House for a vote. A discharge position requires 218 signatures. So that's a majority, a slim majority of the 435, 218 signatures. And if you get 218 signatures, a bill goes to a vote. Currently, 195 congresspeople have signed it. So they need 23 more. And if they get those 23 votes, then the bill will go up for a vote.
I would like us to call on our listeners and everyone that you may know to call Wisconsin Representative Mark Pocan. His number is 202-225-2906 and ask Representative Pocan to sign the discharge petition today. We are just a few signatures away from such a hopefully avoiding disaster, as they would say, in Ukraine. I'm going to call out a few other representatives and give additional phone numbers this half hour. But Representative Pocan is the only Democrat from Wisconsin that has not yet signed on to the discharge petition. Why would folks be opposed to using the discharge petition?
Well, I think that, and actually Congressman Pocan this morning tweeted out that we need to support Ukraine. So I know his heart is in the right place, but he also wants some changes in U.S. policy towards Israel. And I think some of the people that are holding out support for this bill that funds both Israel, Ukraine, and Taiwan, all three of those, some people don't agree with all, you know, all of those positions. So that's one of the reasons. Others, you know, for Republicans, the idea of going around their own speaker is not the best thing. So they would prefer to keep things in the party line. But some Republicans have signed. And I think that for a lot of Americans, the idea of allowing things to go to a vote is very easy to understand. Using procedural maneuvers to not allow Congress people to vote on things is kind of undemocratic. So I think that there's broad support for the idea of letting bills come to the floor and be voted up or down.
Well, that's my response to those that for whatever reasons have questions about and concerns with U.S. continued aid at the levels that it is proposed in this bill to Israel. That's a discussion that can happen. You can make that argument on the floor, but this is about supporting the ability to even bring the bill to the floor and have the vote and the debate itself. Mm-hmm. That is simply irresponsibility. Those are my words, not my guess. Again, Mark Pocan, Representative Pocan's phone number, please call him today. Encourage your friends and family to as well, is 202-225-2906. I'm also going to call out Wisconsin representative from the 8th Congressional District, Mike Gallagher, who is effectively a lame duck. Yes. So, hey, Mike, I've gotten the gist that you're not a Republican that's completely willing to put personal interest over what is best for Americans and best policy. Sign the discharge petition, Mr. Gallagher, and let the debate be had. If you would like to reach out, if you're in the CD8th here in the state of Wisconsin, Mike Gallagher's phone number is 202-225-5665. Catching a thing here, it's always 202-225. And then the extensions are for Mike Gallagher, 5665, and for Representative Pocan, 2906.
Yeah, and I'll just note, you can call once a day.
Yes.
And they care. They care about whether you're a constituent or not. So people who are not from those districts should not call those congresspeople. But if you're a constituent, your congressperson can hear from you once a day.
Yes, and they do. I have worked in government for a long time, up until just a little bit over a month ago. And that's what I would hear from elected officials was, my phone lines lit up. My voicemail was full. Our email inbox was full. They will respond. Obviously, you need to be a constituent. That's who they're representing. So if you live in the 2nd Congressional District, call up Mark Pocan. If you live in the 8th, call Mike Gallagher. Mike's out. I mean, come on. Mm-hmm. Sort of like, what's the problem here?
And actually, if you look at Mike Gallagher's record on foreign policy, there's nothing that suggests he does not support standing up for our allies and supporting Ukraine, as well as Israel and Taiwan. So, I mean, it just, from a policy perspective, it doesn't make any sense for him not to support these bills. I mean, the bill looks very much in line with his work that he's done over the years.
And what he said, right, he has, I would say, a brand of being sort of a reasonable Republican. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, hey, Mike, this is the reasonable thing to do. Let's have the debate on the floor. I wanted to ask you about Alexei Navalny's death in his forthcoming memoir and Putin's relative strength and his reputation. How is the average Russian viewing Vladimir Putin? Did Navalny's death move the needle? How is this sorting out from a man on the street, a woman on the street perspective in Russia right now?
Well, I think Navalny's death was just another kind of very depressing signal of the use of violence in Russia against political enemies. The brazenness of it just shows that Putin is rather unconstrained in terms of what he can do. So it's sad. On the other hand, people did creatively try to show a level of protest against the regime within the constraints that they have by laying flowers on his grave, by his family, his mother insisting on a burial near Moscow rather than way up north in the middle of nowhere. Of course, his wife and daughter could not attend his funeral because they would be subject to, arrest. And people tried in the presidential vote to signal their dissatisfaction with Putin by following Navalny's admonition to vote on Sunday at noon, because it's legal, to vote at any time, and to have these lines out around the blocks on Sunday at noon was a sign of people's support for him. But unfortunately, it's another signal to us of the brutality and cruelty of the Putin regime. And Navalny was very brave, and he even, if you watch the Navalny movie, the documentary that won an award last year, Academy Award, he says at the end of the movie, when the director asked him what happens if you die, he first kind of laughed it off and said he didn't want to talk about it, but then he said, evil flourishes when good people are inactive, so don't be inactive. And it's really heartbreaking because he's saying to people, be brave, do something, even something small, just do the right thing. So, that's the message he left us with, but it's just incredibly sad that he was killed by the regime.
The Alexei Navalny documentary is Navalny, available on HBO Max. You can go check it out. That line, that phrase, evil flourishes when good men and women do nothing and remain silent, has been, I would say, an articulation of an American value for so very long. In other words, even when difficult, even when costly, I think all of us as Americans have taken pride in the fact that we're going to step up as a country, as people, and do the right thing anyways. Again, I'm stunned. This is one of those questions that I continue to be just rattled by, that the political infighting, the elevation of personal power, personal political interests above what is indisputably in the best interests of the United States and every single American is really disturbing. And we can't even get a vote. We can't even get a debate on the floor. Yes, after Alexei Navalny died, and I'm going to put air quotes around that because, again, he died basically a political prisoner.
And he was killed by the regime.
Yes. Thank you, Professor. I didn't want to get out ahead of my skis as not the expert on this, but yes, he was killed by the Putin regime. I took some time and went and researched all of the other opposition folks, journalists who have been killed by Russia or are believed to have been basically assassinated. Many will remember the poisoning in Britain, but that's just one of 20 plus within the last few years, people believed or confirmed to have been likely killed by the Putin regime simply because they disagreed and spoke out or did reporting that painted Putin's regime in a negative light. As you say, Professor, Mr. Navalny was in a long line of those that Putin felt emboldened and still has the power to simply take off the chessboard by killing them. I wanted to turn for the rest of our time today to what occurred this past weekend with Iran's, we touched upon it a little bit at the beginning, but with Iran sending these drone strikes against Israel this weekend, what prompts, why does Iran do that?
Well, it was a retaliation for an Israeli strike on Iranian leaders who were meeting in Damascus, Syria. So Iran is supporting a number of proxy wars, Houthis in Yemen, Hamas, Hezbollah in Lebanon. So Iran is supporting a number of aggressive actors around that are around Israel. And Israel has been in what's called a shadow war with Iran for years in terms of fighting through these proxies. But what was significant about this attack was it was a direct attack from Iran, missiles and drones, hundreds of them going into Israel. Thankfully, very, very few actually got through thanks to Israeli defensive forces and also American, UK, French jets and others, other European allies shooting down some of the missiles. So it wasn't very successful, but it was significant in the sense of it was an escalation from Iran to try to strike at Israel. Because most of them didn't hit, the idea was that this would deter Israel from further escalating into an all-out war with Iran.
Yeah, again, it has been largely a war conducted via proxy. And so the directness of this attack certainly leveling up the conflict that we see there. My thanks, Professor Herrera. You make us all smarter and better informed every time you're here on the Maggie Dawn Show. I hope you'll come back soon. So much happening. Be well, Professor. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. I'll be back with some concluding thoughts this Monday afternoon, bringing it all together and a little bit more on Eric Hovde. Again, thank you, Professor Yoshiko Herrera of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Back with more in just a moment. Wisconsin. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network statewide. If you want to join the show for my last segment today, 855-75-CIVIC. That's 855-752-4842. Boy, Anya, this one flying by. So much going on in the world. Before we had on the expert Professor Yoshiko Herrera, friend of the show, so helpful to discuss the critical juncture that the Ukraine war is at and the intransigence, the cravenness, really, the cynicism of former Republicans, now known as MAGAs and Donald Trump acolytes. There's no reason to oppose Ukraine funding, especially if it was in a standalone bill. Now, we can talk about the complexities of it being in a combined bill with additional support for Israel. But as a point of fact, there's no debate. There is no reasonable debate that the United States interests run counter to Vladimir Putin's. Maybe Donald Trump wants a couple personal favors, but that shouldn't be dictating U.S. foreign policy right now. Again, give Mark Pocan a call. Tell him to sign the discharge petition, 202-225-2906. But before all of that, I was talking about Eric Hovde, who is kind of a clown show, in my opinion. He's just a rich guy who spouts off a not... whatever seemingly runs through his head that he thinks sounds reasonable, he'll say. And like a lot of rich guys and gals that run for political office and think they're entitled to it because they're rich, you have to sort of read what they're saying very carefully. And this is a bit of what Professor Herrera was pointing out. We have a discussion as a country to have about immigration. There is a discussion to have about how the U.S. government supports Israel when there is reasons and to have difficult discussions about how U.S. aid is being used in Gaza. Those are really tough discussions. Let's have them. But to combine and sort of false flag, yeah, I use that term, to conflate these issues, to come up with stupid talking points, to have stupid outcomes for all Americans and Wisconsinites, it is unconscionable. It's wrong. Full stop. And so when Eric Hovde starts slamming overweight people and basically advocating for a fat tax, and it lacks any of the empathy or care about why is it so hard for people to be healthy, doesn't outline or attack the agribusiness industry for basically chucking our food full of so many preservatives and chemicals. Listen, let's have a discussion about health in the United States and weight and how do we support a more healthy lifestyle for folks. But that means talking about agribusiness. It means talking about food deserts. It means talking about the lack of meaningful nutrition education in this country. It means all those things, not just fat tax. We can have a discussion about Social Security and what we should do to continue to provide Americans with dignity and humanity as they enter into their last waning lives. It doesn't mean necessarily take away people's ability to retire, make it harder for them to retire. Maybe we should means test Social Security, you nitwit. But no, we'll just raise the retirement age. That ain't helping solve the fundamental problem. But, you know, he's a multi-millionaire, so whatever I think must make sense, and I'll just spout off. So if you've got your Eric Hovde bingo card, if you made one, get it back out again. Because you get the center square. Oh, yeah. You get that the farmers are lazy. So if you're a farmer, care about Wisconsin farmers, like locally grown produce and livestock, any of those things. You are a farmer. Yep. Called you lazy, so you can check off that Eric Hovde is a jerk bingo card and doesn't know actually what he's talking about. You think a fat tax sounds like a bad idea, or that really isn't getting to the core of the problem with people's health in this country, you got another box that you can check off on your Eric Hovde is an idiot and an inappropriate candidate bingo card. Social Security, if you think people should be able to retire with dignity and that our concern over the care and wellness of people in their later years in this country isn't going to be solved by raising the Social Security age without having a bigger conversation, you can check off another box on your Eric Hovde bingo card. If you think Eric Hovde making a promise that if he didn't get elected back in 2018, that he wouldn't run again and then lying and breaking that promise, you got another check mark on your bingo card. But here's what. If you yourself will become an old person, if you wish to become an old person, if you think you may end up in a nursing home, if you know someone in a nursing home, because my mom broke her ankle late last year in the late summer. She's not ready to permanently check into a nursing home, but she needed that care after she had this terrible ankle break. Eric Hovde basically came out last week and said, yeah, you know, those nursing home people, they're not at a point to vote. What is that? Let's listen to the sound on you.
Well, Sim, absolutely. And I can point them out right here in Wisconsin. We had Zuckerbucks come into Democratic cities in a big way to push out, working with cities to push out Democratic votes. We had nursing homes where the sheriff of Racine investigated, where you had 100% voting in nursing homes. Well, if you're in a nursing home, you only have 5-6 month life expectancy. Almost nobody in a nursing home is in a point to vote. And you had Racine investigated where you had 100% voting in nursing homes. Well, if you're in a nursing home, you only have 5-6 month life expectancy. Almost nobody in a nursing home is in a point to vote. And you had children, adults.
So, you know, old people, nursing home, you don't get to vote. Oh, alcohol. Yeah, we shouldn't have that unless you distill it or brew it in your backyard. So listen, if you think farmers are lazy, there should be a fat tax, Social Security, retirement age should go up. You like liars and you want prohibition to come back. And oh, yeah, anybody who's in a nursing home doesn't get to vote. Guess who's your candidate? Eric Hovde for Senate. I mean, what? I'll go back to my point. You got hundreds of millions of dollars, you're probably disqualified in my book from holding elected office unless you do a hell of a lot of self-education. Mark from Prairie to Sac, I'm so sorry I didn't get to you this week. But not this week, today. It's Monday. I've already Zoomed through to Friday. Who knew? Mark, I will get you tomorrow, my friend. Listen, everybody, I'm Maggie Dawn. You've been listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. We got the Devil's Advocates up for you next. I'll stand up for you.